Locked on NBA Thursday edition. David Locke along with Ben Golliver in a routine January 8th. Suddenly doesn't feel very routine, Ben Golliver. As the night went on, it just got to be bigger and bigger and bigger. We had the fan issue in Boston we'll touch on. We had two players going 40 triple-double in the same game. We had two Western Conference powers going head-to-head, and maybe the clutchest guy in the NBA making a play. And then the night ends with a story out of Cleveland that John Beilein, the maligned head coach first year, one of the great college coaches, used the word thugs while talking to his team. This is a coach who already had players leak out stories about some of his play calls and things of that nature. Thugs is a racially loaded phrase for a head coach to be using. Ben, what's your Ben Golliver of the Washington Post with us every Thursday. What's your reaction to this?
Well, first of all, we got beers being thrown on the courts. We've got players swearing at each other and, you know, calling each other out on Instagram. I mean, it was a night of confrontation. And I do think, like you're saying, the biggest confrontation of all potentially is John Beilein versus the Cleveland Cavaliers players. Now, it sounds to me from the reporting, and obviously we're relying on ESPN.com, Adrian Wojnarowski, for a lot of this reporting, that Beilein's doing everything that he can to make it right. He's reached out to the players. He's tried to clarify that he didn't mean to say thugs, that he was trying to say slugs in reference to, you know, how quickly they were playing. But nevertheless, you know, that's damage control. The damage is done. I think the most newsworthy aspect about this is that it came out so quickly. You know, clearly there are people in that locker room who do not trust him, who do not give him the benefit of the doubt, who do not believe in trying to handle this thing internally. You know, I think a lot of times players in this situation might go to the general manager. The general manager might talk to the coach, and then everybody has a team meeting. They try to move forward and keep it in the family. Clearly that's not happening in Cleveland whatsoever. And as you mentioned, this isn't the first time that there's been kind of pointed leaks toward him. Now, I will say this. I mean, his reputation coming into the NBA was basically spotless. I mean, he was a big-time winner at multiple college programs. He's beloved in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I follow the football team there pretty closely. I know all the media there just kind of, you know, saying his praises for the job he did turning around that basketball program. So I think this is mostly – I'm inclined to believe him that it's a slip of the tongue, but I think it's absolutely a sign – of major problems in that locker room. It just wouldn't come out otherwise.
The question to me, and there's no way for us to answer this, but I think it's relevant, is how does Woj find out about this? Because it's one of two circumstances. It's either, well, one of three, I guess. It's either the players or one of four circumstances. Players or players' agents, one of the members of the front office or organization that is setting, you know, the death trap for their head coach. Like, I think there's a – we'll never know, but there's a relevancy to how this becomes public.
Well, I think another possibility, too, could be that, like, an assistant coach who was in the meeting who apparently did confirm to Beilein when he asked them if he had said it. The assistant coaches apparently did say, yeah, man, like, you know, you did say that. And so, of course, there could be motivations there, too. I mean, I don't want to point any figures or speculate, but I do think I can imagine being in a player situation there, hearing that and being so frustrated and confused by it that you text your agent, maybe you text a friend around the league, and all of a sudden it's now in kind of the rumor mill, right? And so maybe it's not necessarily someone, you know, trying to leak it directly to a reporter maliciously. But once it gets out there, of course, you know, good reporters are going to try to confirm those tips and try to get to the bottom of it. And I think, you know, a lot of players in that situation, I mean, if they're feeling personally aggrieved, like, you know, I would completely understand, you know, from their perspective. I mean, they're going to speak the truth if they get asked about it, and especially if they're kind of off the record and kind of being protected like you would a source in this situation. So there's a lot of different ways it could come out, but the bottom line is, you know, it's come out, and it's very, very damaging for John Beilein.
The only thing I will say is that the sentence "you're playing like slugs" versus "playing like thugs," the sentence "playing like slugs" makes sense.
It does. That's why I'm more inclined to agree, because, look, they're not out there like the New York Knicks getting flagrant fouls and technical fouls every single night. Like, any kind of a context for that word would probably be more towards, like, oh, physical basketball or something like that. With slugs, I mean, I think that's, I mean, it's weird terminology, first of all. It's unusual. But we all know what that looks like. Lethargic effort on defense, not rotating, not closing out the shooters, not covering each other. And frankly, I've watched a lot of Cavaliers basketball this year. They do play like slugs a lot. And that starts with their veteran leader, Kevin Love, who's been pouting for weeks here and not you know, giving max effort. So, I mean, one of those terms definitely makes more sense than the other. But at this point, does it matter? I think that's the bigger question. If you're Beeline, you know, you be honest. You give your side of the story. But I think you also realize that it's going to be very damaging publicly, and a lot of people aren't going to believe you. A lot of people are going to doubt your story.
Well, it does feel as though things could not have gone worse for one of the most highly respected college coaches in the game.
Yeah, and, you know, I think his age probably plays a role here too, because when we talk about the previous leak, it was over terminology and kind of how he wanted to do things his way and kind of bringing this college mentality to the pros. And they have a lot of young players, and sometimes, you know, that college approach of coaching guys up, player development, that can work, right? But it's not a completely young team. They do have some veterans there. They're obviously trying to shop them. But whatever his culture approach was, his communication style, it hasn't gotten through. I think we could say that very clearly from the outside looking in. And so I think that, to me, is a part of the problem as well. You know, is there a, you know, a generation gap here? He's older by NBA coaching standards, and he's also a rookie. And, you know, we've seen rookie coaches who are more decorated than him on the professional level, you know, like a David Blatt, come to the NBA and really struggle with that transition, even when they were gifted all the talent in the world. And you look at this Cleveland roster, I mean, obviously it's not very talented, and maybe we should have, you know, expected some of these twists and turns coming for the Cavaliers.
All right, let's go on the floor, because there was some great games tonight, and then there's some off-floor issues also. But let's get to the on-the-floor game of the night. Dallas and Denver play, and Nikola Jokic is the clutchest guy in this whole league. And frankly, as great as Luka Doncic is, he's not very clutch. Statistically, at least, that's the one flaw in his game. He misses two shots in the final minute, doesn't get the shot off on the final play. And Nikola Jokic with another league-leading game winner.
Yeah, and I've talked to a lot of Dallas Mavericks fans who are sharing kind of the frustration that you're describing with their late game execution. They've been such an incredible overachieving type team this year, but their record could be even better if they perform better late in games. I do want to defend Luka a little bit in this particular game, though, because I thought it was just fantastic defensive game plan coaching from Michael Malone and the Nuggets, and great execution from the players. They jumped Luka at the precise right moment on that final play, forcing him to pass. I thought he made a great read with the pass. I thought he handled the defensive pressure correctly, but Denver did surprise him, catch him off guard a little bit, and did take him away as a scorer. I just thought it was really smart coaching. The guy in the corner receiving the pass needed to do better with it. He needed to either just catch and shoot that three, take one dribble, step in, and pull up. Instead, he forced a pass back out to the perimeter, and that's why they kind of went home as losers. In terms of what you're saying about Jokic, I'm fascinated, because we really don't see a lot of go-to late, you know, late game scorers anymore. You know, be big guys. I mean, usually that's the role for the guards, the playmaking wings. Are you kind of casting him almost as an anomaly now in today's modern NBA? I mean, he's that's big praise from you, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, the numbers are undeniable, right? Got it earlier this year against Minnesota. I think he, in the last 3 years, has the most game winners of anyone in the league. I actually got this listening to Adam Mattis on Locked On NBA. He and Anthony Irwin did kind of who you'd want to have take your last shot, and Adam said put no Nikola fourth in the NBA, but basically said statistically he's number one by a large margin, and it's true. I think it's that a little bit to this, everyone's so scared of his passing that nobody's willing to double. But he also has the versatility. That's a fadeaway, tough look against Minnesota. This one's a power move to the rack. He has the versatility to do a lot of different things.
You're right. And he's got the – doesn't he get so many soft and good roles too? I feel like a lot of his game winners rattle in. I mean, they're not like Kawhi Leonard four bouncer, you know, one in a million type shots. But he's just got this way of kind of getting into that – that mid-range, that short mid-range, lofting shots up and having them go down. He was, again, great offensive execution, seeing the switch, getting the mismatch, and him realizing that it wasn't time to make the pass. It was time to go to work and just back down the smaller defender and get right to the rim. It was really well done by him in that situation. And I actually think he was very big in some key moments in last year's playoffs, too, and maybe didn't get quite enough national attention for his play in those situations, partially because maybe they weren't the sexiest series, you know, against San Antonio and Portland. But at the same time, I trusted him. I would definitely want the ball in his hands late in games. And I think you're right. He deserves to be near the top of that list, even though most of the rest of the guys who are probably in that conversation look a lot different and play a lot differently than he does.
He's Ben Golliver of the Washington Post. I'm David Locke. It is Locked On NBA. So if Jokic is one of the clutchest players in the league, what other things does Denver need to hit on your checklist to be considered one of the Western Conference elite teams and possibly even a Western Conference favorite?
Well, look, they're an elite team. We could look at their record. We could look at their performance. I mean, they're in that conversation. I think the question for me, though, is, okay, they don't have premier playmaking wings, right? They're just doing it different than everybody else has done it. And what we've seen here, whether it's the Warriors with Kevin Durant, Klay Thompson, whether it's Toronto with Kawhi Leonard, whether it's, Cleveland with LeBron James for all those years. Like, if you really want to be in that championship title conversation, that's usually the formula, right? So Denver's either got to buck all of modern history and do it their way and show that, you know, Jokic can actually be the very best player on a title team, or they wind up kind of falling into that second-tier group where a lot of other kind of unorthodox teams have maybe fallen in the past. I'm thinking of teams like the Grit and Grind Grizzlies, the Philadelphia 76ers to date with Joel Embiid, right? Where that, you know, you're winning games at a high clip during the regular season, but it maybe doesn't translate when you need to get into these, interchangeable lineup situations in the playoffs, lots of switching, you know, dealing the matchup game. And I just, when I look at these matchups, whether it's Nuggets versus Clippers or Nuggets versus Lakers, you know, in a potential, say, second round or Western Conference final series, I just think they lose the matchup game with the players they've got in those spots, you know, whether it's Torrey Craig or, Will Barton, who's had a really nice year, Jeremy Grant. I just think they're giving up too much talent in those areas.
They're incredible offensively. I mean, for the last now quite some time, they're functioning about a 120 offensive rating for about the last 15, 20 games. I mean, this is the elite offensive team in the NBA right now that was Dallas earlier this year.
Well, and they should be, too. I mean, I think that was the frustrating thing about the Jokic slow start is that when he's not playing as well as he can play, and we know he's an all-NBA level first-team guy. I mean, that's what he should be every year. I mean, that's where his talent level, his vision, his passing, his scoring combination, that's what that suggests. But when he's not playing like he can, or, you know, he's taking nights off, or he's just, you know, not engaged every single night, he is such a willing distributor that it affects everyone. It affects their entire offensive rating. There's not really any way to compensate for it. So it's good to see him lift his individual game and have that kind of, you know, rise the tide for all of their boats or whatever that phrase is. I've also been impressed by their defense overall, too. I think they're still an above-average defensive team. That's a nice formula, too. If they can get, you know, top 10 on offense and top 10 on defense, that's one more thing to kind of check off and say, hey, you know, this would be an elite team. I guess my questions, you know, my big picture questions for them are not, you know, are they a top three or four team in the Western Conference? Can they claim home court? I mean, I think they've shown that they can. It's just, are they really able to beat the very best of the best in the playoff matchups? I think that's the remaining hurdle for them to climb.
All right, let's go on floor / off floor before we go off floor, well, or things flying on floor before we go back on floor in this crazy night. Jimmy Butler and TJ Warren have got a new WWE show coming up.
Look, I think Jimmy's getting a little bit too into this bully mentality, okay? Like, we all know TJ Warren can't guard Jimmy Butler, and that says something about Jimmy Butler, but it also says something that we've known about TJ Warren for his entire NBA career, right? Like, he's not out there to be the lockdown defensive piece. He's out there to get a lot of people a lot of fantasy points and to help the Pacers offense stay afloat without Oladipo and after losing a guy like Bogdanovich. So I think Jimmy might want to pick his battles a little bit better, you know, like set your standard a little bit higher than TJ Warren if you're going to be going one-on-one on Instagram and all this other stuff. I did think it was a strange and potentially dangerous play for him to grab Jimmy's arm like that, so I wasn't surprised by the initial anger reaction. In a worst-case scenario, you could see a guy separating a shoulder, you know, being dragged like that with his momentum going so hard. I think there needed to be, you know, maybe be a little bit more of a de-escalation or an apology from TJ Warren on that play, just given how awkward it was. But, of course, you know, you give Jimmy an inch to get mad, and he's going to take a mile. I mean, that's been his personality his whole career.
The interesting one about Miami is, as good as they've been this year, statistically, offensively, Jimmy Butler has not been that good. Now, Eric Spoelstra had a nice kind of conversation the other day about, you know, all the things you do about winning, and that's why they have Jimmy Butler. But, I mean, he's not shooting well from three. He's not particularly efficient offensively. They don't go to him late. It's very interesting how they use him.
Yeah, I think that they're getting, I would say, a lot of mileage out of his playmaking ability more than anything. Because, yeah, the efficiency stuff hasn't been there. I think he's a better shooter than he's shown. If you compare his season shooting numbers to his career numbers, I think we would expect there to be, you know, some progression as the season unfolds. But he's been a skilled passer. I mean, he's a guy, even back when he was paired with Derrick Rose, he had these visions of himself of, you know, being the Chicago Bulls point guard, right? Like, he wanted to be that lead playmaker, not a full James Harden where you're doing everything, but he wanted to be a little bit more of a passer. I think he is a team-oriented, unselfish, you know, type of guy when it comes to passing the basketball and moving the basketball, maybe more than he gets credit for, because his personality overshadows that aspect of his game a lot of times, and his reputation in Minnesota and in Philadelphia kind of precedes him a little bit, you know, in terms of being confrontational. That's a huge aspect of their game. And they're not winning games one-on-one. They're winning games because they trust the pass, everybody moves the ball, and they have a lot of capable and willing scoring threats on the court at all times.
All right, on the floor, Russell Westbrook does not play today. James Harden's line, digest this, 9 of 34, 4 of 20 from 3, 19 of 23 from the free throw line, 41 points, 10 rebounds, 10 assists, 3 blocks, 2 steals. What am I supposed to think of that?
I mean, at some point, we're going to have to come up with thresholds that we can call the Harden, right? Like, if you can score 40 points but make fewer than 9 shots or fewer than 10 shots, is that the Harden? You know, something along those lines, because I do feel like this is getting to be routine for him. You know, I would also just point out this game was even uglier than the final score indicates. I think Houston won 122-115. I mean, they were up big again over Atlanta early. It did feel like, you know, at least tracking the box score in the first half of that game, that he was going to try to go for 60 again against them. They just have no answers for him. So I wouldn't personally read too much into this game, just because Atlanta is barely a professional NBA team when it comes to defense, and it just kind of feels like all numbers put up against them should maybe have a little bit of an asterisk.
Yeah, I'm just still looking at that 9 of 34 and 4 of 20, and I don't know what to do with it.
Well, I know. It's like, well, 41 on 34 shots isn't the worst, you know? I mean, obviously the free throws are doing a lot of subsidizing there. The 4 of 20 is interesting. I do think that he has a little bit more variance in his three-point shot making than anybody in Houston wants to admit. This would obviously be most likely one of the worst shooting nights of his career. I think the other factor here is, why was Daniel House mad, right? Because I think he kicked the chair. And I do feel like sometimes if I was one of Harden's teammates, as spectacular as he is and how he's so great at getting his teammates good-looking scoring opportunities, if my teammate went 4 for 20 on threes, I might be inclined to kick a chair. I'm just saying.
It reminds me of one of my favorite kind of enlightening stories I got from an NBA player. I'll tell it in just a second. David Locke along with Ben Golliver, Locked On NBA. Tomorrow, Adam and Anthony are with you on Locked On NBA for the Friday edition. Also, if you haven't followed it yet on Instagram, Locked On NBA Net is on Instagram and on Twitter and doing a lot of fun and exciting things, updating you on all the news and giving you the best audio clips around the league from the local experts on the biggest stories. Jeff Hornacek, when explaining to me why he kind of retired, said, you know, I used to drive to the arena every night with a little angst to me. Like, all right, if I don't play well tonight, we're in trouble. Like, I got to get going. And then he's like, in the last part of my career, I was coming off the bench, and I started just driving to the arena. And I was like, all right, it's time to go. I wonder how the Rocket players drive to the arena, right? Are they thinking, oh, I got to play well for us to win tonight? Or, oh, I'm here to watch James.
Well, do you think this is why they set up the whole red carpet entryway, right? You know, it's like, at least let the guys have a nice pregame fashion show before they go stand in the corner and, you know, wait for their catch-and-shoot opportunities. Look, I'm being way more harsh than I actually feel on this. I think that their system is intelligently designed. I thought it actually worked really, really well with Chris Paul. I wish they would have stuck with it. The Westbrook factor has really aggravated me, and I don't see that playing out very well. But this is one more thing to track if you're looking at Houston in terms of how things could go poorly for them in the playoffs. When the burden gets heaviest on Harden, when he gets the most tired or the most fatigued, when defenses are keying on him and they have better defensive pieces in the postseason, when he's facing the league's best defenses, the efficiency stuff does come down. And, you know, you can win a game over Atlanta shooting 4-for-20 on threes. You can win it going away. No problem. You're not going to beat the Lakers or the Clippers doing that, you know. And ultimately, that's how we judge success for Houston. It's like they make the finals this year or it's a failure. And the Westbrook trade looks even worse than it already does. I mean, I don't know about you, but remember, Westbrook's getting paid an extra year of max money, and they gave up first-round picks and pick swaps in the Chris Paul for Westbrook deal. Chris Paul has been a better player, more efficient, more win shares, better offensive rating, better defensive rating, better player efficiency rating. I mean, name an advanced stat that matters. He's outperformed Westbrook this year. He's more deserving of being an all-star player. And I think, frankly, like, he's fit in much better in Oklahoma City than Westbrook's fit in Houston. So that trade, to me, it's like 75% of the way towards a disaster and an early playoff exit in a scenario where Harden's just being asked to do too much and it doesn't go well. To me, that would just seal its fate as a disaster.
Two all-star spots available: Devin Booker, Donovan Mitchell, Chris Paul, Russell Westbrook.
You know, I think ultimately the coaches are going to reward the experience, you know, with Chris Paul and Russell Westbrook and the name recognition. I think Booker, the injury does probably hurt him a little bit. I would have had him in until they, you know, they fell off more recently as a team and he missed some time. Mitchell's case to me is super fascinating. Now, are you assuming Rudy Gobert is in?
No, I just think I'm thinking about guards at that point.
Oh, I see. Yeah, because I think Utah's going to get one representative. And so I think if I was voting personally, I would give Utah's representative to Rudy Gobert and probably leave Donovan Mitchell out at that point. But I think one of those two will get in.
Brandon Ingram or Rudy Gobert?
I would go Rudy Gobert, personally. And I wouldn't really think too much about it. I mean, I'm a guy who always wants to reward winning, spread it around a little bit for all the playoff teams. And also, I think, you know, defensive impact, you know, where the team is, and the fact that he's still an efficient offensive player. I mean, all those kinds of things. When you're looking at what's driving Utah's success, I still feel like they're winning defense first. I still think he's in the defensive player of the year conversation. He's right at the top of the list in most of the major defensive individual statistics. So to me, that's where I would go. Also, I think, you know, there needs to be a little bit of a makeup call, you know, from some previous years where I always had him the last 2 years. I thought he was like the number one snub in the Western Conference. So to me, I'd have him in.
If Russell Westbrook, I don't swear on our podcast, but if Russell Westbrook gets in over Donovan Mitchell, I might.
Well, brace yourself, man. Brace it. You know how these things work. It's tough.
I mean, seriously, get how can the, we can the, we stop with the, Russell Westbrook's killing the Rockets this year?
No, I'm. Hey, look, you're preaching to the choir on that. I went about as hard as I could possibly go without swearing on the last 5 minutes here. I'd say this though. Remember, the guy who I always look to for tracking Donovan Mitchell's career arc is Damian Lillard, just because the small market team, dynamic guard, sneaker deal, build the whole thing around him, you know, let him go wild, you know, very marketable, great personality, fans love him. I mean, there's so many parallels between those two guys. And Lillard, remember, was knocking on the door of that club, the All-Star Club, for years and not getting in and was just so frustrated by it. And I just worry that Mitchell might be subjected to the same thing. Now, you could flip it around and say, look, if Utah's going to get one representative, the voters or the coaches might decide, we'll give it to Mitchell. He's more marketable. He's flashier. He's more of a quote-unquote all-star player than Gobert. I could see that argument developing for sure. I just don't see a scenario where both get in. I think that's the tricky part.
Fan issue in Boston with San Antonio. Do we have a fan behavioral problem in the NBA, or do we have just a bunch of flipping knuckleheads that are?
Well, I like the way the broadcast handled it, I thought, very well. I mean, the broadcasters went right at the fans saying, that's not acceptable, you can't do that, and they were very hard on it. So I give them credit for that side. They've got cameras. They could figure out who threw it. I mean, I trust the technology on that. Hopefully that's at least a season ban, if not a longer ban for that fan. Going back to the incident that prompted it, though, You know, Kemba Walker, to me, he was the victim of an illegal screen by LaMarcus Aldridge. I thought Aldridge was leaning forward enough that the referees missed that call. I also thought, though, that Kemba Walker launched himself backwards, you know, kind of in a borderline flop situation. I don't know if he needs to be fined for the flop, but I certainly think that he laid it on very thick. And I thought everything that happened from that was adjudicated properly. I think he should have gotten 2 technical fouls for the way he treated the official, and I thought Brad Stevens should have gotten a technical foul for what he was saying as well. So I think it was a very unfortunate scene, especially once you got to the aspect of, you know, stuff being thrown onto the court. But I think ultimately the only real miss was Aldridge leaning on, you know, kind of a bang-bang call that, you know, sometimes goes your way, sometimes doesn't.
On the All-Star conversation, how do you view Trae Young?
Well, he might be the very trickiest guy. I think, you know, with his numbers, and that's funny too, right? Because we're harping on Harden's 40-point triple-double and how much does it mean. On the other side, you've got Trae with 42 points, 13 rebounds, 10 assists in a game that they lose, you know, going away despite kind of a late-game comeback. So do those numbers mean anything, right? And then you look at his defensive impact, and he remains one of the worst players from a defensive impact in the entire league. I think there are a number of very deserving candidates with less flashy numbers. You know, guys like Spencer Dinwiddie, Malcolm Brogdon, who, you know, are more, I would say, more deserving than Trae Young of an All-Star spot. But something tells me that he's kind of going to be the anointed one a little bit. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he winds up getting himself on that team.
I don't know if it was Tom Ziller or somebody. Somebody wrote an interesting piece about it recently, about just how, frankly, their offense isn't that great when he's on the floor, as much as everyone says he's carrying their offense, and their defense, and his defense, is just atrocious.
Yeah, my only counter to that is that their offense without him is, like, again, like, borderline unprofessional. Like, so, I mean, like, the one-man Trae Young attack is not equivalent to the one-man Luka attack or the one-man Harden attack or the one-man LeBron attack, where it's like, if those guys are on the court, it's, like, automatically elite or, like, very, very good. That's not the case for him. So I do think that if you want to make the case he's got empty stats or his impact falls short in a major way from what his numbers would suggest, I'm on board with that. At the same time, I wouldn't write him off as a player. I think that all of Atlanta's problems to me are what's around Trae Young and how old those players are and the stability factor of not having John Collins for most of the early season. I would not be pointing to Trae Young when I'm casting blame there.
And I have one last final thought for you tonight, Ben Golliver, as we wrap this up. You know your franchise is not very good when you don't offer Emmanuel Mudiay a contract and then you play here and he's better than anyone you have on the floor.
Let me guess, the New York Knicks were in town.
They were, and Emmanuel Mudiay was the best player on the floor for significant portions of the game tonight.
Well, first of all, I'd say congratulations to him, because that's sticking with your career, right? I think a lot of guys might have given up after 2 spots didn't go right. So it's nice to see him carve something out for himself. On the Knicks side, I actually just saw them here in Los Angeles last night, I guess one night before you saw them. And it was just a disaster from top to bottom. You know, there really wasn't any positive takeaway. A guy I really feel bad for would be RJ Barrett. Definitely feels like he's just kind of going through the motions, trying to survive, keep his head above water, tread water, you know, whatever analogy you want to use. Certainly his decision-making and his passing ability really has a long way to go. You know, I think there's too many nights where he's getting 0 assists, 1 assist, and that is super concerning given how much you want to have the ball in his hands as a kind of a lead playmaker. And then the efficiency stuff has been an issue too, but I mean, there's flagrant fouls, guys, you know, like Bobby Portis knocking opponents out of the air with a flagrant foul, technical fouls, bad body language, young guys not necessarily being on the same page as the old guys, so many conflicting interests, and, you know, they've already had the coaching change, and you know there's trades coming here for them in the next month or so. So it's really a mess. I mean, there's no way around it. There's not any real use in sugarcoating it.
Well, they didn't have Randall or Morris tonight, so they were not particularly good. And R.J. Barrett did not show a flash, which was a little bit of a bummer. I was excited to watch him. He did not show a single flash the entire night. But they were on the last game of a road trip on a back-to-back, so we'll give him a pass. That wraps up the night of Locked On NBA. Tomorrow's edition, Anthony and Adam will be along with you. Remember to follow Locked On NBA Net on Instagram and Twitter. On behalf of Ben Golliver, I'm David Locke. This has been Locked On NBA. They went ISO on rejecting the screen today, so tell your smart device to play the most recent episode of podcast Rejecting the Screen.